It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI. I'm Ann Strainchamps. You know those end-of-the-year lists? Best books, movies, music? Well, this hour is a collection of our best interviews from 2015. And maybe it's because I ask questions for a living, but one of my favorite interviews this year was about questions. 36 specific questions designed by a psychologist, and they've been known to help people fall in love.
What is the greatest accomplishment of your life?
What do you value most in a friendship?
What is your most treasured memory?
What is your most terrible memory?
If you knew that in 1 year you would die suddenly,
would you change anything about the way you're living now?
What does friendship mean to you?
What roles do love and affection play in your life?
How close and warm is your family?
Of all the people in your family, whose death would you find the most disturbing?
How do you feel about your relationship with your mother?
What, if anything, is too serious to be joked about?
When did you last cry in front of another person?
Or by yourself?
If you were to die this evening with no opportunity to communicate with anyone,
what would you most regret not having told someone?
Why haven't you told them yet?
Those are some questions, huh? I mean, some of them I haven't even asked myself, let alone anyone else. Imagine asking them on a blind date. 20 years ago, psychologist Arthur Aaron designed those questions for a study on love and intimacy, and he used them in a famous experiment.
A man and a woman, heterosexual, walk into a lab. They answer these 36 questions, and then they stare into each other's eyes without speaking for 4 minutes. One couple who did the study later went on to get married.
Mandy Lynn Catron wrote a column for the New York Times recently called To Fall in Love with Anyone, Do This. It's the story of how 20 years after that experiment, she read about it and then tried it herself one night with a guy she'd just met. And they fell in love, too.
We were at a bar and we were just sort of chatting about relationships. And he was saying, I have this theory that you could fall in love with anyone, you know, assuming you have a certain number of common interests. And then I said, well, actually, you know, someone has tried to make people fall in love in the lab and said, you know, I've always wanted to try it. And he was like, let's do it. And so we did.
Did you feel anything start to shift or change as you were asking these questions?
So the original study is designed to take 90 minutes. We spent probably twice that amount of time talking. And I did feel like I went from not really knowing this person to knowing him quite well over just a few hours. I think it would be hard to really honestly answer the questions and not feel that way.
And did he feel the same way, do you think?
I think so, yeah.
So then what happened? You get all the way through the questions, then what?
The second component of the study is that you stare into each other's eyes for 4 minutes. And he was like, well, like, do you think maybe we should do that too? And I kind of hesitated. So we walked down the street to the bridge because we wanted to go somewhere that wasn't too crowded and did the 4 minute staring in the eyes. It was very uncomfortable.
What was uncomfortable?
It was a good experience. I think you just have to be kind of brave to just look at someone and let someone look at you for that amount of time. I mean, at least the first couple of minutes were pretty uncomfortable.
What changed?
You kind of settle into the experience. You sort of drift out of that sense of like looking into someone's soul or whatever into just sort of being really present in the moment. And I don't know, other people would probably have different experiences, but that was mine.
And then are you guys together now?
We are, yeah.
Do you still stare into each other's eyes?
Occasionally, yeah.
That's Mandy Lynn Catron's story. She wrote it for the New York Times Modern Love column. So what is it about those 36 questions? Arthur Aaron is the social psychologist who came up with them. He's a researcher at UC Berkeley and Stony Brook University, and he studies love and intimacy.
We were trying to create a laboratory procedure to create a feeling of closeness between people, not necessarily romantic closeness. But that's not to say it couldn't support the creation of a romantic feeling.
So you basically took two people who'd never met before gave them a bunch of questions and watched to see if they got closer over the course of an hour?
Yes, and we kept piloting it till we made sure it did get them closer. And then we and others, there's been hundreds of studies using this procedure now. It works. At the end of this 45 minutes or so of the activity, people report being almost as close, feeling almost as close to this person as the closest person in their life. Now, it doesn't necessarily last, but at that moment, they're feeling an extreme sense of connection.
So what happens after the study participants, these strangers, they come into a room, they ask and answer all these questions, they feel really close, and then what, at the end of the hour, they have to leave? Don't they want to see each other again?
Some of them do, some of them don't. And in fact, when we were doing versions of this with cross-sex heterosexual couples, and we had a little more romantic version of this, we made sure they left separately so they didn't feel any obligation to connect with the person.
So you did one couple, right, in one of the early studies who actually did wind up falling in love and getting married?
We don't know for sure they fell in love, but they did get married, and we presume they fell in love. I don't remember if they actually invited us to the wedding, but they certainly let us know they were getting married. And I actually contacted them a few years ago, and they were still together.
Well, so the point, it seems to me, is that these are not some magic questions. It's the process of self-revelation, right, and finding out about each other that fosters intimacy and opens the door to falling in love.
It certainly fosters intimacy when it's mutual, and the responsiveness, feeling the other is responsive to you, feeling yourself being responsive to the other person, have a huge effect in creating intimacy. Mm-hmm. Now, falling in love, we haven't tested it for that.
You've been fascinated by love for a long time. How and why we fall in love, how we do or don't manage to stay in love. We all know that passion and intense involvement fades. Why is that? Why does passion fade?
Well, let me say first, it doesn't always. We've done some studies with people who've been married 30, 40 years who claim to be very intensely in love. There aren't a lot of them, but there are some. Bianca Acevedo, who is the lead on this study, this was her dissertation study, she told me she interviewed one of the couples, and she could see it, but they were saying to her, we really annoy our friends. These were like 70-year-old people. We really annoy our friends because we're always all over each other physically.
Who are these lucky people? What do they have going on in their brains that the rest of us don't?
Well, we'd like to know. But we do know some factors that definitely increase passionate love in long-term couples. One of them is actually doing those 36 questions with another couple. So if you just recently met another couple and the two couples get together, spend an evening, do those 36 questions, we just published a study a month ago showing that it not only makes you close to the other couple, it makes you closer to your own partner and actually increases the passionate love with your partner.
So double dating actually improves your own relationship?
Yes.
Why would that be?
Two things. One is we have a lot of research evidence that doing anything novel, challenging with your partner reinvigorates a sense of excitement with the partner. And this is an activity that's like that. We've done other studies where we measure this in other ways. So we have people come into the lab and we tie them together at the wrist and ankles and have them go back and forth trying to push something with their head. And we've done studies where people every week do something from a list of things that are exciting. And after 10 weeks, they're more satisfied and more in love.
What's on the list? What are the exciting things?
We were talking about things they could do in one evening or one afternoon, you know, going for a canoe trip. If they've never been to the opera, going to the opera. If they've never been to a horse race, going to a horse race. Doing something different. We've done some recent research suggesting it doesn't have to be something entirely new. It can be what we call a rediscovery activity, something you haven't done in years. My wife and I were walking back from a play in Manhattan to the subway one night, and we, you know, were somewhat older, and we walked by a bar, and we said, you know, we haven't hung out in a bar in years. Let's go and hang out in a bar for a half hour. It was wonderful.
And why do you think doing something exciting and novel can reignite the spark in a marriage or a partnership?
We associate the process of expanding the self when it's rapid expansion of the self is very has a very rewarding experience. It feels really good. You know, in the early stages of falling in love, there's all that excitement. But then you get used to the partner. So then you do something together that's exciting. and you associate that with the partner.
Hmm.
One of the things that happens when we connect with someone is the other person becomes part of who we are to some extent. So what a relationship does for us is it expands the self in the sense it increases who we feel we are.
So we feel bigger.
We feel bigger. We want to be more than we are.
Arthur Aaron studies love and intimacy at UC Berkeley and Stony Brook University. He also developed those 36 questions. And if you'd like to try them with a friend or a partner or anyone, you'll find the full list and instructions at ttbook.org/questions. One book that made it onto just about every Best of 2015 list is H is for Hawk, writer Helen McDonald's story of how she tamed a wild goshawk. Steve Paulson loved the book, and we loved his conversation with Helen.
I want to back up for a moment so we can understand how you got to this point. Your father had died suddenly from a heart attack, and you'd been very close to him. And the way you write about this, it was devastating. I mean, you were slipping almost into some kind of madness.
Yes, I think after big losses, the world really does fracture. You know, and I was very, very good friends with my dad. He wasn't just a great dad. He was kind of, you know, we were kind of partners in crime, really. We both shared obsessions. He loved aeroplanes, I loved birds, and we used to wander around with binoculars, sort of looking up at the sky. And he had a massive heart attack and was suddenly gone, very suddenly. We didn't even know he had any heart problems. I just started doing something very strange, and I just started to dream about goshawks.
You started to dream about them?
Dream about goshawks. So every night I'd go to sleep and I'd wake up and I'd have this image of a goshawk flying through my dreams and slipping through air into nowhere, you know. And I'd been a falconer for many, many years.
Going back to when you were a girl, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'd been really obsessed with hawks. I was this very strange child. But I hadn't flown hawks for a while, and I never wanted to fly a goshawk. They are these legendarily difficult birds of prey to train. They're incredibly highly strung and nervous. They're very murderous and predatory, and I just didn't want anything to do with them. And then suddenly, they were all I could think about.
So you started dreaming about them, and you decided to get one.
I decided that to deal with grief, I should train a goshawk, and I don't recommend this to anyone who's listening. It's not a particularly good way of dealing with loss. But they spoke to me, and this whole decision to get a goshawk and train it came on a level that was really beneath conscious examination. I think, again, when you lose someone very dear to you, you know, you stop thinking logically. What drives you are very deep emotions and needs, and I just needed this goshawk. So I bought one off the internet.
So you brought home your young goshawk and named her Mabel.
I did.
But my sense was, even though you had all this experience training falcons when you were younger, you didn't really know what to do with her.
Well, I knew the steps. I knew the steps to training a hawk. I knew that it was all, you know, I'd done it many times before. I knew it was all done through positive reinforcement with gifts of raw steak. And I knew that you had to withdraw to a darkened room for the first few days to get the hawk used to you. You know, she jumps to your fist, then flies to it, and eventually you fly her free. I knew all those steps, but I didn't really know who I was anymore. And that sounds really overblown now, but I was a mess. And the more I watched the hawk to try and understand what she was feeling so I wouldn't scare her, the more I empathized with her to such an extent that slowly I sort of forgot who I was. You know, the whole world shrank to just the hawk, really.
You were really cutting yourself off from your friends, from the human world in general.
I was. And I think the hawk, to some extent, was an excuse, because you do have to withdraw from the human world when you start training a hawk. You get them used to you initially. So I unplugged the phone, I drew the curtains, I told my friends to leave me alone. And that kind of radical isolation, I think, wasn't just about training the hawk. It was because I just didn't really want to know about the world anymore. I didn't like it.
Well, you say that there was a period when you were becoming more hawk than human.
Yeah. I started to see the city through her eyes. And obviously this is all in my imagination. I didn't really see through her eyes at all. Hawks have got extraordinarily different sensory worlds from us. You know, they see more colours than us. They see polarised light. I mean, I didn't share her literal vision. But I would come out and stare at what was going on, and it would baffle me. I'd sort of wonder what a bus was. You know, why is that woman throwing a ball for her dog? Why would you do that? You know, the whole city became very odd. And then later, when the hawk began to fly free and hunt her own food, I really felt that I wasn't a person anymore. I just ran around after her on the bright open hillsides around Cambridge and watched this great natural drama, which was, you know, the hunting behavior of a wild hawk. I became this feral creature covered in mud and blood and thorn scratches. I didn't ever wash my hair, you know, I was a mess. But it was an incredibly good way of forgetting that I was miserable. Hmm. You know, I didn't feel anything.
I mean, the way you write about this too, I mean, you participated in the kill. I mean, Mabel, your hawk, would catch, let's say, a rabbit, and you would then sort of take it out of her talons, and you'd snap the neck to try to quicken the death.
What happens in the wild with goshawks is they're not particularly bothered about what they're, you know, if they catch something, they just start eating, and at some point, obviously, as they eat, the poor thing's going to die. So I had to get in there and put these things out of their misery. And that was a really astonishingly strong and affecting and serious moment every time. You know, as I ran around with the hawk, I felt like I was an animal. I just felt like I could fly. But every time I had to kneel down and administer the coup de grace to some poor rabbit, I felt intensely responsible and very, very human. And it made me realize, you know, we don't really see death very much generally anymore. It all takes place behind walls, often in hospital, with animals in slaughterhouses. And suddenly, you know, the great irony, I guess, is that I was running away from death, and yet there it was every single day. And it was a deeply, educational experience. That makes it sound like I'm making light of it, but it was very serious.
Well, you're also talking about wildness here.
Mm, yeah.
Have you sort of figured out what that means, to be wild?
Oh, my goodness. I guess the weird thing about goshawks is that we see them, and most hawks, we see them as these remote symbols of wildness. And of course, Mabel was very, very wild. You know, she was kind of made of this sort of mysterious thing. But then I'd bring her home, and she'd sit on my hand, and we'd watch television in the evenings, and we'd play. You know, I'd throw her scrunched up bits of paper, and she'd catch them in her beak and throw them back to me. You know, so I mean, she was a much more complicated and bewitchingly strange and interesting and contradictory creature than just something that was made of wildness.
Hmm. Now, there's another thread to this story, and that's your fascination with an old book published in 1951 called The Goshawk by T.H. White, who's best known for his Arthurian fantasy novel, The Once and Future King. Why were you so interested in T.H. White's experience with his own goshawk?
Well, I read it when I was young. I was a very precocious reader. I was, as you know, I was obsessed with Birds of Prey, and I absolutely hated it. it was about a man who was trying to train a goshawk, and he didn't seem to know what he was doing. To the point when the bird was clearly suffering greatly as he tried to bend it to his will. And I remember as a child, you know, flinging the book down and sort of shouting. At one point, I went and sort of complained to my mother that he was doing it wrong.
And T.H. White was, I mean, your portrait of him is, he was a tortured man. His parents hated each other. They didn't seem to care about him. He was beaten as a child. He was gay at a time when you couldn't be.
Yeah.
He was pretty miserable.
He was, and this is the very sad thing about White. He saw the goshawk as a lot of the things that he wanted to be. You know, being gay, being broken in many ways, having had a horrendous education. He wanted to train this hawk in an enlightened way. He wanted to train it without punishment, because you can't punish hawks. You know, obviously, you can't even shout at them. They don't respond well to that. And he liked that idea. He thought he could educate the hawk, you know, in the way that he should have been educated. But he saw the hawk also as something kind of feral, as slightly gay, as slightly sadistic, all the things that he felt himself inside to be that he'd always been fighting against. So when he was training the hawk and trying to civilize it, it was a really weird way of him trying to sort of civilize himself. And it became a battle with himself in the form of a bird. And of course, the bird really came out quite badly in this battle, because the bird almost disappeared in his eyes. You know, it was just a battle with himself.
No, you've talked about how there was a period when you were kind of becoming more hawk than human. I mean, you were sort of slipping away from the human world. How did you re-enter our world again?
Yeah, it got really bad. You know, I started to do things that goshawks did. You know, I'd either stuff my face with food and then not eat for days, or I'd not eat at all, and I'd literally hide behind the sofa if I saw people go past the house. I mean, I got pretty nuts. And I sort of realised, and it was at my dad's memorial service in London, I realised that I'd bought into that old chestnut that nature writing books tell you to tell you, that, you know, when you're broken, if you run to the wild, it will heal you. It will be a sort of place of solace and renewal. And I'd just gone way too far. So I went to a local doctor and we had a long talk, and I ended up going on antidepressants, which were very, very helpful, and also made a big effort to see people again and really try and negotiate that balance between, you know, wild and tame that I'd got very, very wrong. And I managed to crawl back into the world slowly. It was a very, very strange experience. I remember looking out of the window once and checking the weather, and usually I'd check to see whether it was raining and whether it was too windy to fly the hawk. And I remember just one morning suddenly thinking that the sky looked very beautiful. And at that moment, I think I knew that things were going to be okay.
Helen McDonald's memoir is called H is for Hawk. Steve Paulson talked with her. So there's a bird that's kind of a holy grail for hardcore birders, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Like the Loch Ness Monster, it's not even supposed to exist. It's been labeled extinct for 150 years, except every few decades, somebody spots one. And one sighting in 1932 launched an epic expedition to find, photograph, and capture the first ever recording of the rare bird. Craig Ely has the story.
It's 1935, and Jim Tanner is wading through a Louisiana swamp looking for an ivory-billed woodpecker. He's part of an expedition from the Cornell Ornithology Lab to record the calls of America's rare birds. And the ivory-bill is the rarest. In fact, just a few years earlier, most people thought the country's largest woodpecker was extinct. So when a Louisiana legislator walked into the state game office and asked for a permit to shoot one, they humored him. A few days later, he triumphantly displayed his trophy, with a scarlet crest and white beak. It was a male ivory bill. Word spread quickly among birders. The ivory bill was still out there. At Cornell, they hatched a plan. The head of the lab, Doc Allen, convinced the American Museum of Natural History to fund the trip. Paul Kellogg loaded a truck with 1,500 pounds of recording gear and microphones, many of which he designed himself. Jim Tanner, a promising grad student, went along to help out. He was 21 years old and kept a diary throughout the trip.
Wednesday, February 13th. Left Doc's house at 9:15 a.m. Good day for driving. Roads are clear and a nice sunset. Arrived in Washington at 9:30 p.m., Ambassador Hotel.
They head south, toward the spot where the ivory bill had been shot. It's a plot of Louisiana forest owned by the Singer Company, whose plan is to one day turn the trees into sewing machine cabinets. The recording truck is too heavy for the swampy roads, so they unpack the gear and transfer it to a wooden cart. They enlist a local farmer and his two mules, who lead the cart toward the interior, where they hope the ivory bills are waiting. The first few days, nothing.
Friday, April 5th. Went out looking for ivory bills, but had no luck all day. We heard several turkeys gobble, slapped at many mosquitoes, felt a bit discouraged in the evening, but figured we would find them soon.
The very next day, with the men spread out across the swamp, they hear a female ivory bill and follow her calls to a large stump. There's a woodpecker hole in the middle.
Then the male suddenly appeared and flew into the nest hole. He clamped on the lower part of the nest hole with his feet. He looked around. His big white bill and white eye were in stark contrast to his black face. The crest was long and scarlet, and every one of us had his eyes glued on the bird.
They found the bird, but they still needed what they came for. They needed to record it. 2 days later, they start moving the equipment toward the nest.
While we were resting the mules, I heard a kint south of the road and followed it. It called some more, and once I saw it fly, it sounded as though two birds were talking, and right near there we found a hole high in a tree. Without much trouble, we took the wagon in, and soon after that, Paul had the apparatus set up.
That was the first, and possibly the last, recording of an ivory-billed woodpecker. Those few days in Louisiana launched Tanner's life's work, defending the bird and its habitat. He went back to the swamp for the next 3 years to study the birds and wrote the definitive book on the ivory bill. He fought against the logging of those Louisiana woods and lost. Jim Tanner died in 1991, having last seen an ivory bill in 1939.
Craig Ely brought us that story. In the last 10 years, there have been two other reported sightings of an ivory-billed woodpecker, but despite extensive searches and surveillance, neither could be confirmed. So to date, the best documentation remains what Jim Tanner found back in the 1930s.
It's the great God bird with its all.
We're sharing some of our favorite interviews and stories from the year in this hour. Coming up, poet Claudia Rankine's award-winning book-length poem on race and citizenship. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. One of the best books of poetry published this year is Claudia Rankine's book-length meditation on race, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award. The cover is simple. It's a black hoodie set against a white background, and the title is Citizen, an American Lyric. Claudia Rankine sat down with Charles Monroe Kane to talk about it, beginning with this section.
You and your partner go to see the film The House We Live In. You ask a friend to pick up your child from school. On your way home, your phone rings. Your neighbor tells you he is standing at the window watching a menacing black guy casing both your homes. The guy is walking back and forth, talking to himself, and seems disturbed. You tell your neighbor that your friend, whom he has met, is babysitting. He says, no, it's not him. He's met your friend, and this isn't that nice young man. Anyway, he wants you to know he's called the police. Your partner calls your friend and asks him if there's a guy walking back and forth in front of your home. Your friend says that if anyone were outside, he would see him because he is standing outside. You hear the sirens through the speakerphone. Your friend is speaking to your neighbor when you arrive home. The four police cars are gone. Your neighbor has apologized to your friend and is now apologizing to you. Feeling somewhat responsible for the actions of your neighbor, you clumsily tell your friend that the next time he wants to talk on the phone, he should just go in the backyard. He looks at you a long minute before saying he can speak on the phone wherever he wants. Yes, of course, you say. Yes, of course. I like the ending of that piece because one of the things that I think happens with racism is that everybody's response then gets complicated by trying to avoid it or, you know, move away from it. So, you know, that actually happened to me. Mm-hmm. And when I said to our friend, you know, the next time you should just go in the backyard, I meant it as a way of avoiding the aggressions and the fear and the paranoia of our neighbor. But in a sense, I was telling him that he should curtail his own rights.
I want to talk to you about pronouns. Your use of you and I, and again, the you and I always assumed when I first started reading the book was someone who was black, and then he mm-hmm. and she that I assumed was white. Mm-hmm. So that's how I read it. And then things started to get really muddied about a third of the way through the book. And then I was like, wait a minute. Who is she talking about here? Is this about me? Is it about mm-hmm. the black community? And so I guess it begs the question, who is this book for and who is it not for?
Well, it's for Americans. It's for citizens. And the use of the second person was intentional. What I wanted to achieve structurally was a environment where people would have to orientate themselves relative to the pronoun.
Right.
Because you often hear people say, you know, I don't think about race. I just see people. So I wanted people to read these pieces and see their own minds place one body in a black body or a brown body, place another body in a white body, see themselves relative to that situation and say, oh, wait, I did this. I didn't do this. I would never do this. I clearly am not that person. I've never received that treatment, you know, et cetera. And see if in their own minds they lined up the participants according to race.
There's another poem in your book that really struck me, and I think it's a poem you added in way after it was published and had a new publication so you could put Eric Garner and Michael Brown in. It's a very powerful poem, and it says, in memory of Jordan Russell Davis, in memory of Eric Garner, in memory of Joan Crawford, in memory of Michael Brown, in memory, in memory, in memory, in memory. And it goes on till it fades. And then it says, because white men can't police their imagination, black men are dying. Could you tell me about that poem?
That was written in response to Darren Wilson. When he said that thing, that seeing Michael Brown was like seeing Hulk Hogan, that he was a demon, I don't disbelieve him. I think that for him, the black body is this thing that is larger than life, even though he, you know, Michael Brown is bigger than him in terms of weight, but I think they're relatively the same height. So I wrote that down as a line, because white men can't police their imagination, black men are dying, thinking that it would lead to other lines. But I got stuck there because it seemed to be at the heart of the problem, that the ways in which the racial imagination is created, it has at its root this kind of, this sense of fear and loathing, basically, of the other.
Now, you went down to Ferguson, right, before the grand jury decision. What was that like?
When I went, I just happened to be in St. Louis, and so I went to Ferguson. And it was very sad, actually. I ran into some young black men, and one of them kept saying to me, I look just like Michael Brown. That could be me. So that sense of identification with a dead body was something I wanted to run from. You know, I found it really appalling. And then I ran into another woman, and she had a toddler with her. And she said to me, do you want to take a picture of the boy with his hands up in the air? And again, I felt like, no, I don't. I don't want to take a picture of your toddler in the hands up, don't shoot position, because I don't want that analogy determining his life. And so in a sense, that's me being a little bit in denial about a kind of reality that is true for, you know, for black men in this country and definitely for black boys and men who live in Ferguson.
You know, you're a professor in California and you're very intelligent and you've lived life and you knew before that grand jury decision what that decision was going to be. What was that like too? You knew they were going to be acquitted, right?
I knew they were going to be acquitted, and I wanted them to be indicted. So so there was still that 1% of me hoping. And I think this is true, you know, I don't want to speak for all black people, I don't know. But certainly for me, there was and continues to be, again and again in these situations, a kind of jaded, I know, they're going to be acquitted. I know they're going to be acquitted. And yet this private hope that they will be indicted. So that's why you wait. You know, you're in this constant sense of waiting. And the wait becomes like years and years and years and years until it's a lifetime.
Is this book the words for that weight?
I think these are the words for that weight. I think the book, for me, was a very personal exploration of what it feels to live the weight and what it looks like.
Citizen by Claudia Rankine won this year's National Book Critics Circle Award for poetry. She talked with Charles Monroe Kane. Another memorable conversation about race we had this year was about racial discrimination and voices. Working in radio, we think a lot about voices, and we're all aware of how easy it is to make assumptions about people based on what they sound like. Raymond Tungekar had a really interesting conversation about that with actor Keith Powell. You maybe remember him from his years on 30 Rock. He's now writing and starring in a web series called Keith Broke His Leg. And he told Raymond that one of the most difficult things about working in Hollywood is dealing with how people think black men should talk.
Before I got on 30 Rock, I would always do auditions and somebody would go, that was great, but can it be a little bit more urban?
Wait, really? This actually happened to you?
Oh my God. This is a completely accurate story. I actually was just told that a week ago. The person who auditioned me was like, but I mean, this character is down. There's so much more down than what you're playing. And I was like, what does that mean? So it happens a lot for a lot of black actors, unfortunately.
Yeah, I feel like there should be some kind of study looking at the coded language that directors...
It's a lot of coded language, yeah. Which is ironic because I was born in West Philadelphia. Frankly, I'm from the streets, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I'm, you know, my mother was on welfare. I lived in not the best neighborhood. You know, I'm the guy that a lot of people say are, like, street guys. And, you know, I don't talk like that, and a lot of my friends don't talk like that, who also come from humble beginnings.
Well, I understand that early on you actually adopted a really interesting strategy to kind of avoid these awkward conversations.
Yeah, well, I just would literally like walk into audition rooms with an English accent and then do the script as if it were just me and then go back to the English accent when leaving, completely making them think that I was British. And I never got the note of, can you make it a little bit more urban again? Huh. It just made my life easier.
Well, you know, and that gets to this question I have. I mean, voice and racial identity are so closely intertwined, right?
Yeah.
And I would imagine that for someone to say that you're talking or acting white, it kind of suggests that you're less authentically black, right?
Correct. I mean, that's exactly what happens. And it's kind of disgusting. I mean, it goes into identity. And it goes basically back into how you were raised and what perceptions you were raised with. I mean, it very much exposes your own personal biases that you didn't know that you had if you identify race and voice. I sound like a black man because I'm black. Right? Like, voices don't have color. And if someone looks at me and goes, well, your voice and your body don't align, it makes me go, well, then what do you think I should have sounded like?
You know, I'm reminded of something that I think it was John McWhorter, the linguist, that said it. Mm-hmm. But he basically talked about how, you know, white students have the space and freedom to kind of explore different identities. You know, you never hear people say, call someone a white goth or a white stoner.
Right.
And yet, if someone of color does that, I mean, they're perceived as acting white, right?
It happens all the time in comedy, specifically, where identity is taken away from you. In comedy, you're not just the golfer, you're the black golfer. Or, you know, I've auditioned for parts where it's called black guy. Like, your entire identity is boiled down to your race, is a trope in comedy. And it doesn't happen for a lot of white comedians. Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about another episode from the series, the most recent one, Mellow.
Yeah.
And, you know, it involves...
I'm the most proud of that.
Can you just briefly talk about what happens? Maybe just give, like, a short description?
Actually, this episode is based 100% on a true story. my wife in the episode throws a karaoke party in the backyard, and the police get called, and comedy ensues.
You the owner of this house?
I am. What's the problem?
We received a noise complaint about the music you're playing back there.
I will tell them to turn it down.
It's probably a better idea if you just turn it off.
Can I ask who reported me?
Sir, a few of your neighbors called us. This is a work night. Now, I know this might not mean much to you, but there are plenty of residents that need their sleep. So a little less partying and a little bit more humility would be greatly appreciated.
Adam.
Okay. I will tell them to turn it off. You can go.
Have a nice rest of your night, sir.
You know, the new racism, because we live in the age of Obama, is not to be racist. It's to use coded language. And it's happened to me, and it's happened to me by police officers. Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a real story. It really happened.
Well, do you see your comedy as kind of pushing against that type of narrow thinking and or that biased thinking? I mean, do you see your comedy as serving some kind of social justice purpose?
Well, I'd like to think about it as the anti-stereotype, right? In comedy, a lot of people, you have to kind of boil people down to their essence in order for it to be identifiable quickly, and then you can make fun of it, right? That is a structure in comedy, and it's a natural thing. So it's not just specific to race. It is specific to the dumb hillbilly or the valley girl. What I'm hoping to do with Keith Broke His Leg is kind of take that and put it on its head. I like comedy that's a little slower. And when you take comedy that's a little slower, that you don't have to reduce somebody down to a joke, you can still get the laughs, but you start seeing a human being in there. And that's kind of how I feel like the Mellow episode goes.
So what do you say now when someone at an audition asks you to, you know, sound quote-unquote more urban?
I just take the note and do it the way that I want to, that is authentic to me, and then let the chips fall where they may. That's the thing, you know, that's the thing that I've learned throughout this journey and throughout making this web series is how do you survive in an industry that needs you but doesn't want you? And the way that you survive is to be yourself and to speak your truth. And you certainly don't have to fight to have your truth be heard, because sometimes it won't be heard, but the best you can do is just speak it.
That's the actor Keith Powell talking with Raymond Tongakar. You can check out his web series, Keith Broke His Leg, at getbroken.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, actor and filmmaker Terry Gilliam tells Doug Gordon what it's like to pick up a newspaper and read your own obituary when you're not dead yet. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Forty years ago, Monty Python released the classic comedy Monty Python and the Holy Grail, the movie often listed as one of the funniest of all time. It was co-directed by the only American member of the troupe, Terry Gilliam. He went on to direct other award-winning films like Time Bandits, Brazil, and 12 Monkeys. And now, on the eve of his 75th birthday, he's released an illustrated memoir called Gilliam-esque. Doug Gordon caught up with him.
Terry, the cover of your new book, Gilliam-esque, is suitably Gilliam-esque. There's a photo of your head with the top sliced open, and there are all these animated figures popping out, including, of course, the famous Monty Python foot. And it says on the cover that the book is a pre-posthumous memoir. What does that mean?
Correct.
Why?
Because it's just an honest statement. It's very simple. I'm not dead yet, and that's about it. The publisher said, oh, but shouldn't that be preposterous? No, it's preposthumous.
Yeah, but it has to do with this whole thing that happened last month. So tell me about how Variety killed you.
Well, I had been in France with my wife, came back and discovered I had been dead. Actually, by the time I learned about it, I had already been resurrected. But there were those missing hours that I didn't realize that I was experiencing the afterlife. I just thought it was another boring airplane flight. But that's the afterlife for me. Somebody, and it's not really been explained to me, how somebody at Variety pushed the button that triggered the headline that said, Monty Python's Terry Gilliam, director of Brazil, dead at XXX. And below that was my obituary. And I responded to it saying, you know, that I had died from so many bad reviews from Variety.
Yeah, and then a lot of tweets with Python references that people...
Of course,
Like Variety has downgraded Terry Gilliam from dead to merely a flesh wound, and Terry Gilliam is not dead, he's resting, he's stunned, he's pining for the fjords.
The whole thing was just incredibly funny and perfectly timed, I thought, for the promotion of this book.
Yeah, it's perfect. Did this whole really surreal experience change the way you viewed your life and your impending demise, which we hope is still many years away, decades even?
No, it doesn't. I mean, the interesting thing is when my wife and I started having children, she suddenly became aware of her own mortality, and she never thought about her death before. And I said, I've thought about my death every day, what I do. Maybe it's because, you know, keep your enemies close.
Yeah.
So hold death close to your chest and it won't happen.
That's a good attitude. I would think that one of the most difficult creative challenges you faced in your career was making this move from being this one-man operation, creating animation for Python, and then moving into what's, you know, this really isolated work you're doing, into what's probably the most collaborative art form there is, film directing. How did you make this transition?
It began by directing Holy Grail and then realizing I don't want to direct the Pythons ever again.
Why not?
At that point, I wasn't particularly good at verbalizing exactly what I wanted and why it was needed to be done in that way. And they were impatient because they just wanted to get on and do the jokes. But when I did Jabberwocky the first on my own, it was that moment when I'm working with these terrific actors, these great famous comedians, and I, as the director, would say, do this, and they did it without arguing. Whoa, this is amazing. This is kind of fun. And so it started rather easily. And in a sense, it was a nice change from, one could argue, the loneliness of the long-distant animator.
I like that. That's great. That could have been an alternate title, not as good as Gilliam Mask. That would make it, that'll be the sequel. You got to write a sequel,
great,
the memoir.
You.
That's great. I love that. You've made a lot of great films like Time
Thanks.
Bandits, Brazil, The Fisher King and 12 Monkeys, and many others. Is that there's something that a unifying factor, something that you think all your films have in common?
I don't know. I mean, I think on many of them, at least, there is that battle between fantasy and reality. There is that. How far can your imagination take you before reality runs over you? There's clearly a sense of anti-authoritarian attitude in there. And there's also, in many ways, the innocence of a child, the pure way they see the world. It's either a child or a lunatic is like that, so they tend to be in the films.
Yeah, you say that your films have always been repositories of idealism, and I think when you're a child, that's one of the times when idealism really runs high, and you tend to be more idealistic, and then as you get older, reality kind of bashes it out of you.
I think the other problem, too, for me is where childhood and youth is all about so much to explore, so much to learn, so much to discover, all the vast world that's out there that you don't know. So there's all of that you're aspiring to knowing more about. And as you get older, it goes the opposite direction. I'm not surprised anymore. I know too much.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That is depressing
when you
see humanity repeats the same mistakes, the same stupidity goes on and on. It's like, as a species, we don't seem to be very good at learning.
Yeah. You say that one of the main misunderstandings of your films comes from the kind of trailer speak where the man with the deep voice says, "We're going into the mind of Terry Gilliam."
Yeah.
And you add, that's the last place you want to be, and that's the reason you make films, so you don't have to be stuck in your own mind. And it makes me wonder, raises the question in my mind, what's wrong with being in the mind of Terry Gilliam? It seems to me it's a very imaginative, interesting, and fascinating place to be.
Only when I'm making a movie or talking on the radio about my life. The reality, as my wife will attest to, is miserable. I'm a grouch. I'm a grump. I'm a curmudgeon. I don't speak when I'm at home. I grouse around the place.
I find that hard to believe, but I'll take you at your word. If you want a bad place to be, you should try being inside my head. That's a house of horrors.
Really?
Oh, yeah, it's bad. It's bad. I was surprised to learn that you created an idea for a theme park attraction, an idea for an attraction called the Body Ride. Can you tell me about that?
Well, years ago in Britain, somebody had the bright idea of doing a kind of British Disneyland, and they asked me to do the Body Ride. It was going to start with a great bowl of soup, it looked like, and you'd get in pea pods and hollowed out corn cobs and carrots. You would ride the food in to a great big mouth with chomping teeth and then be sucked down into the gut. You're going to have to deal with antacid pills being dropped down trying to stop things. And you probably escaped into the bloodstream. And we know where the ride ended, don't we?
I think we do. You don't need to say.
Terry Gilliam is the author of Gilliam-esque. He talked with Doug Gordon. That was a very Gordon-esque interview. By the way, this is music from the soundtrack to Gilliam's 1985 movie, Brazil. That's it for our show today, but don't worry, there's more in our podcast feed. Get your fix by looking us up on iTunes or Stitcher. And don't forget to leave a review. That helps other people find the show. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tangakar, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music is from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.